do not adjust your Pulse Audio settings, normal service will be resumed as soon as possible. But in the meantime, this is Season 2, Episode 23 of the Tux Radar Podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Excellent. And in this episode, we're looking at K-Office becoming Caligra. We've got our superb discoveries of the fortnight this time, unlike last episode.
We won't hear.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
It's my fault. Sorry.
I wasn't here to check
that's
on
true.
You.
All, it all went to pot.
Yes. And we have our open ballot looking at, is this the year, well, will 2011 be the year of Linux on the desktop? Finally. So,
brilliant question.
If you love our podcast, then you'll also love our magazine, Linux Format, and you can subscribe at tuxradar.com/subscribe. Okay then, let's kick off with the news. And the biggest event in the last couple of weeks is that K-Office is now Caligra, or it's forked to be Caligra, or as their press release puts it, Caligra is a continuation of K-Office. Now that's remarkably vague to me. What is it, Graham? Is it a fork? Is it a spin-off?
I think we all know about the same amount of information, but it's all from the same press release. I don't really understand what's going on with the KD team. It seems to me that they've suddenly got sick of K things. Hmm. So, but they don't want to get rid of K. So they switch K to C, and then we have Caligra, which sounds like some false Great Pacific Battle in the Second World War, but it isn't. Yes, I don't know. It's the rebranding of lots of the main applications in the K-Office suite.
Yeah, so I mean, K, what was the word processor called?
K-Word.
K-Word is
what it is.
It's become Words. Which
not to be confused with Word.
Yeah, well, I wonder if Microsoft will have a beef with that, because there was K-Illustrator and Adobe asked them to change the name a while back. So, yeah, the spreadsheet has become Tables.
Yeah, that is better than K-Spread.
It is, yeah, because you know, K-Spread could be some sort of butter substitute.
But it's still a terrible name.
Yeah, and the presentation tool is now Stage.
And then the other ones stay the same.
Kexi and Critter.
Yeah.
two of the most obvious names in the KD canon.
They haven't changed. They're staying the same. What's one of those is the GIMP alike, isn't it?
Yeah, one is the drawing program.
Which does have native CMYK and is therefore really good.
Whoa.
It is actually really good. I mean, it's an often overlooked editing tool. But it's excellent. I mean, the great thing about it is that the UI, I think, is very good. There's lots too many options. But it actually makes that SDI mode where you lock in panels around the main canvas work really well, so that everything stays in a single window while still having floating palettes. Yeah, Critter's good.
Hmm. Kexi is the flowchart one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or diagramming.
Isn't there a project managing one?
Project.
K-Project.
Yeah. I've never used it, so some people swear by it.
But there was something slightly cryptic and in the press release where it said most of the developers have moved over.
Yeah, like other people don't agree with it.
Yeah, so which does suggest it's a fork. That
yeah.
Is K-Word going to continue while Words... is developed in a different direction, or
maybe it's a LibreOffice style fork.
Ah,
where most people go off and then only a few people remain.
Hmm.
But also, much like everything else in KD, this is an announcement before anything actually happens, before any code is written. It's the announcement that they intend to create this new suite. But it's going to be a long way off. It's going to be the middle of next year before they probably redraw all the icons and change the colours.
I think you've been a bit cynical there, Graham.
I'm sorry.
Because Inge Wallin, the Caligra marketing coordinator, said the changes were not merely cosmetic. But would help the project to position itself as a platform beyond the confines of the desktop. I'm reading out from the page that we're going to print in news.
Beyond the confines of the desktop.
Beyond the confines of the desktop.
Onto my carpet.
Well, with a new name for the suite, this is her talking now, with a new name for the suite and new names for the productivity applications, the Caligra community welcomes a new stage in the development of free productivity and creativity applications for desktop and mobile devices.
Oh,
it's a he. Sorry.
No, that.
So there we go. That's beyond the desktop onto mobile devices. So you can look at spreadsheets on the move.
Wow. That's totally re-dynamizing the strategic parameters of paradigms. Why do they feel they have
and
to do
all
this?
That just by changing the K to a C?
I don't know. That's... KD often use that kind of language, don't they?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think maybe in German it sounds great. And the person that's responsible for translating it to English actually thinks that that's the way we all speak and that's what we expect to hear. You know, maybe all they've watched is The Apprentice or something.
Well, they were in Hamburg the other week, weren't they?
Were they? No, I don't watch
it. Oh, that was really good. Stuart Baggs, the brand, for the win.
Oh, right. Is he one of the entries?
He's ace, yeah.
Right. Has he been evicted yet?
He hadn't last time I watched it, but then that's not been for about a week or so.
Okay. Is it can't have long left to go on it, can it?
I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I don't even have a telly, so.
I'm a celebrity in the office.
Oh, right.
It's really cool. It's an exercise in people watching and the stupid things that stupid people say. It's just awesome.
Damn those stupid people, eh? Yeah. But, I think, like you say, Graham, they should get some stuff out there before making these grandiose announcements about, you know, re-harnessing everything. They should have something we can download, something to say, wow, that looks really cool, that's worthy of this name change and relaunch and stuff. But coming up with this, it reminds me of the Magea Mandriva project where they were talking about logos and roadmaps and stuff before they actually had any code or any distro or any packages. It's just talking in advance.
So. I mean, that's slightly different because I think that was, at least that was necessity. You know, it was jump from Mandriva now or we all go, it all goes down the drain. So I can see how with a project like Magea, the people who do the art and the people who aren't technical necessarily are going to talk about all the things they want to get involved with. Well, hopefully the big contributors are there and talking to one another, thinking, you know, oh, we've really got to move this forward somehow to make it a success. Mm. Whereas this is it goes along the line of them renaming and splitting, you know, all the KD desktop components. Yeah. You know, something that I still can't get my head around.
Well, there's phone on and solid and...
Well, yeah, but what is it? The SD or the SC?
Software compilation.
Yeah. The KD software compilation alongside the main desktop. I don't know. I like simplicity. And if Caligra is a new generation of K Office applications, I kind of expect to see it. You know, this is so special. This what we've been working on for the last 12 months. We've decided to call it something new.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas this all seems to, you know, the cart before the horse.
Yeah, it's about politics, isn't it? So, meanwhile, OpenSUSE has announced Tumbleweed, which is a rolling release version of their distro. So.
Right. Is this different to OpenSUSE? Is it going to be in parallel?
It's not going to replace OpenSUSE. The main OpenSUSE will have regular point releases. So 11.4 is due out in March. And then presumably they'll have 12.0 after that. But in the meantime, if you want, you can still get stable updates to packages through this Tumbleweed branch. They've had something called the OpenSUSE Factory for a while, which is the development super bleeding edge branch. But for those people who want to have regular package updates instead of having to wait 6 months or 8 months or a year to get all the latest stuff, they can follow Tumbleweed now, which is a strange name, but...
I suppose it is a strange name.
Yeah.
Does it mean then that if you follow the Tumbleweed branch, that you will have 11.4 in March?
I think so, effectively, yeah. I mean, I think the idea is, you know, you're running 11.3 and then GIMP 2.8 comes out. Now, you can either wait until March to get the next SUSE and get that application, or you can follow this Tumbleweed branch, and after a few weeks, you'll get the program anyway. Once it's been packaged up and determined to be stable, then you'll be able to get it. So, yeah, I'm assuming that's the way it'll work by March. You'll already have 11.4 effectively installed. So,
well, we talked about rolling updates in the past, and I think we all thought it was a really good idea. I mean, there are several reasons why. Firstly, people who are interested can always stay up to date. But secondly, the side effect is that when you do take a branch of a snapshot of the distribution at any one point, you know that it's going to be upgradable from a previous version, because that's what everybody has basically been doing with the Tumbleweed branch. And, you know, OpenSUSE needs to do something, I suppose, to distinguish itself from the other distributions, especially now when its future and philosophy is a bit uncertain.
Yeah, but I'm glad they're still keeping the point releases because they're essential for things like documentation and being able to give somebody a platform that
marketing.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're writing a book about a Linux distribution, you want to be able to know exactly what people have without the software versions jumping around in between. So.
Wow, can you imagine what kind of person would be cool enough to write a book about a Linux distribution?
I've only heard of such people in the myths of old.
I know. Yeah. How is your book?
Oh, it's great. It's on Amazon, the Haynes Linux Manual.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and it might actually be on in bookshelves at the moment. In
all good bookshops near you.
You've not been to check?
No.
And move it forward and all that.
Scatter the copies around in front of everything else.
That's the Haynes Linux Manual by Mike Saunders, available in all good bookshops and all good Amazons near you.
And it's hardback as well.
Hardback.
And includes a CD-ROM of Ubuntu.
Full of lovely Haynes goodness.
Yeah, full colour.
Other books are available.
A release party.
Yeah. No, I'm not allowed to drink any alcohol at the moment. Listeners, I missed the last episode because I had glandular fever, which was by far and away the worst thing I've ever had. So, yeah.
Yes, it's awesome. Bad. It was bad. We didn't mention anything.
Really? That's nice of you.
Yeah.
So, the readers just assumed I was dead.
Well, we kind of kept quiet. You know, Paul was enough.
And moving on to the final news piece, the Linux Foundation has released a report on the makeup of the kernel, and they've announced that over 70% of the work done in the Linux kernel over since 2005 has been done by paid developers, and that's more than 6,100 individuals from over 600 companies. Is that a surprising figure to you, 70% paid?
No, it isn't, because they did a report a few years ago that said almost exactly the same thing.
Mm.
And I can't remember what the figure was, whether 70% is more or less than, but it's certainly in the same ballpark as the number that they announced. I think it might be a little bit more.
I'm quite surprised that 30%, that's still a good third of the development, is done by people in their spare time. I thought by now, with Linux being so big in business and, you know, such a technical project and kernel hacking, that, you know, it would have been like 90-95% being done by serious full-time developers, whereas a lot of hobbyist developers are writing desktop applications and things to go on fresh meat. So that's quite reassuring that the community still has a big say.
Do you know whether it's actual fixes or lines of code?
I don't know. I presume it's based on lines of code, but I'm not sure. We'll have a link in the podcast notes.
Because, it would make more sense that, I mean, if it's fixes, then that would be in the amateur's favour, wouldn't it? Because they can get all the small stuff.
Well, there is the kernel janitors project.
Yeah,
isn't it?
We can go in and
clean things up by just making minor fixes.
So this is over 600 companies have contributed to the kernel since 2005.
Mm.
Is there any breakdown within that? So could Red Hat, for instance, have contributed, you know, 69%.
Yeah, there will be a breakdown.
Yeah. And then it is a Red Hat, IBM, Novell, Intel, I think, are the four biggest. Mm-hmm. And like you say, they make up the vast, vast, vast majority. Whereas, you know, there are small companies that might have only added or changed four lines, just something specific.
I guess if some printer company wants to add its drivers to the kernel, then that counts as an addition.
Yeah, but it might be a one-off thing, a code dump.
I suppose... Yeah, if you remember last time, the big scandal was that Canonical was something like 12th in the list of contributors, and was a sub 1%, as I remember, less than Mandriva.
Hmm.
So it'd be interesting to see what Canonical, if Canonical has done anything. I mean, as we've talked about before, it's not a reflection on how much Canonical does for the Linux community, because it does a lot of desktop space stuff.
Well,
it is interesting.
As I saw you guys discussed last time, that 200-line kernel patch
which
speeds everything up. I mean, that's absolutely minuscule. It's almost
exactly
trivially tiny for the 30 million lines of code or whatever in the kernel.
But it will have a really, really big impact.
Exactly, yeah. More so than a 10,000-line driver for some old serial card that hardly anybody uses. So just those 200 lines could change Linux desktop computing forever.
It's a bit like when the UK Independence Party say that whatever 80% of our laws are decided by Brussels, they're not really telling the full picture, because they're stupid laws about the length of bananas.
Hey, that was very important to me, I'll have you know.
I suppose we should also mention that Chrome OS has been delayed until the middle of next year.
Was it due to...
It was due to be released now.
Really?
Yeah, that's something that... I was anticipating it, lots of people were anticipating it, and I think just last night, or just over the last 12 hours, they've released a beta candidate or an alpha candidate that runs on a netbook, and they've said the final release won't be until next year.
What's holding it back? Pulse audio problems.
Yeah. They probably. Well, no, they're probably getting rid of all of that stuff if they're getting rid of X.
Are they trying to? Are they going to? If they're getting rid of X, does that mean that K album will still run?
I might have to recompile it to work on Wayland or whatever they use, but I'm sure it'll work. I'm sure K album will be here long after I'm gone.
After you. Don't despair, listeners.
Right, it's now time for Discovery of the Week.
Yay,
which is actually more it's more like Discovery of the Month.
So everybody should have lots of discoveries.
It should be really awesome.
Yeah. Sorry for that fail, that egregiosity.
We got so carried away in the conversation last time.
We did.
Nothing to do with it not being in our notes.
We got excited because Mike wasn't here.
Yeah.
We could.
You had freedom.
So we've all been discovering lots of things. As we've just been talking about Chrome, I'd like to step in now with my discovery, and that is that they're just on the verge of releasing a Chrome netbook. This is Google, and it's not going to have a caps lock key.
Eh?
I know.
Well, how will I type lol and really inflammatory?
You'll just have to hold down shift, I suppose. It means that when
double tap shift.
It means that when you're shouting on the internet, it'll be harder for you.
Man,
that's nice. That's nice. The thing is, little kids like pressing the caps lock key because it lights up.
Oh yeah.
But have they replaced the caps lock key with an even cooler key?
Well, the key that you accidentally hit when you're typing at speed is no longer going to become turn all of your words to shout. It's going to open up a search
tab becomes Google search. I mean, caps lock becomes search.
So you'll hit that. So you'll be typing away on a document, and you'll accidentally hit search, and then search for all the secret things you're writing about.
It'll open up some browser window
that
you can use to search the Googles.
But you'll be doing that by accident a lot of the time, and your document might be quite confidential, but then you'll be searching for things, and they'll be tied to your IP address in Google's logs. Dodgy.
Google wouldn't do something like that on purpose, though.
It would purely be by accident, just like them collecting all that Wi-Fi data. Yeah. This is all alleged, by the way.
So, yeah, there we go. I'm in two minds about that. I don't like caps lock, but then when I look up and find that I've been writing stuff in caps lock, I sometimes just excuse it by writing, "Oh, look, caps lock," and then carry on as I was.
I don't often hit a caps lock key by accident, but then I seldom use it, probably like most other people. I can't remember the last time I actually used it for a reason.
I was going to ask our listeners to tell us when they'd last used a caps lock key, but I'm sure now there's been lots of messages in caps.
Is this the year of Linux on the desktop?
No!
It's not shouting. It makes it easier to read. What? Hey? Yeah, so that's me, and I've gone first, and there's no Paul, so that means...
Well, there's...
That means we're forced to think of other things.
Well, I do have my one from the last episode that I didn't use, which was a kind of a negative one, but it might be helpful for someone, is that in KDE 4.5, you can change the mode of your desktop. Right, so you can have it as a picture, for example, or you can have it as a full screen folder view, or you can have it as an animated background, or I use a script that I wrote to change it to astronomy picture of the day. Now, the thing is that whichever you choose, it changes the name in the right click menu on the background, so you don't ever know which one it is to get back to the settings to change it back. So if you want to switch between a picture and the folder view, you don't know which menu item to select.
Ah,
it's really annoying.
Good work, KDE team.
What's even worse is, and this is the discovery, that if you've locked your Plasma desktop, so the little cashew thing lets you lock the widgets to the background so that you can't inadvertently move them. If you've got that enabled, when you go back to that option to change the desktop mode, you cannot change it. It's all grayed out. And this had me really scratching my head for a while. Why is it grayed out? Why can't I change back between a picture and back between a script or back between the folder view? Why won't it let me? And the reason why it wouldn't let me is because the Plasma desktop widgets were locked. Unlock them and you can change it again. Also, you have to close the window and reopen it again. It doesn't automatically update.
Whoa.
That's my first negative discovery, which really is an inconsistency. My second one is a really cool piece of software. that I saw mentioned on the recent Blender blog post. It's called Insight 3D. It's open source. It works in what it does is you take lots of photos of a building, for example, or anything, all from different angles, or you happen to have a load in your photo collection, and Insight 3D collates them all, works out from what angle they've been taken and from how far away they've been taken from said object, and constructs a 3D model of the object you've been taking a photograph
of. That's brilliant. I want to do that with my head.
Well, exactly. You could do it. Theoretically, there's nothing stopping you taking lots of pictures of your head, throwing it into Insight 3D, and then getting a 3D model of your head.
This is so cool. I'm actually going to write this down on my notes now.
Insight 3D. It's Photosynth. That's the application that kind of made this.
Is it a FOSS free?
Yeah, it is.
Brilliant.
Because what it came up on Blender because they'd like to integrate that kind of technology into the application. It's happened. You know, with the open source drivers for the Kinect camera,
the
360. Someone's done a very similar thing in real time. I don't know whether they're using the Insight 3D libraries, but what they do is they use the two cameras on the Kinect to create a parallax 3D impression of what they're looking at and actually constructing a real 3D model of what it's looking at.
I've seen those videos on a gadget. Yeah,
so it's doing the same thing, but with your own photos. And what is amazing is that it adjusts for lighting, for angle, for distance, for all of those kind of things that your camera does when you're taking photos of a building and compensates for it to create a model.
But presumably, with this, you have to know how to use Blender as well. And I've
Insight 3D is at the moment independent. It's
nothing
to do with Blender, and I've not used it, so it does look relatively complicated. But the videos that the demos that they show looks the output looks fantastic, and it just seems like magic. You know, when you've a long time ago, I used to construct models in Lightscape. You know, pointing and clicking on three axes. And just to think that you can all, you know, do away with all of that by taking lots of photographs of something you want to model and throwing it into a software application sounds amazing.
I can see myself playing around with that.
Great for open source,
Making things automatic is much better than...
And organic, because you always cut shortcuts, you know, when you're creating models. You should put in more points than you do. But, you know, this isn't... There's no shortcut.
Cool. Well, I've got two discoveries. And the first one, a positive one, which is LibriVox, LibriVox.org. And this is a free audiobooks website. It's like Project Gutenberg, but people have recorded themselves reading out these books. So you've got hundreds, thousands.
Brian Blessed?
No, unfortunately.
Stephen Fry?
It's just normal schmoes on the internet.
Mike Saunders? The woman who did the voice of the Cadbury's Caramel Bunny.
Oh, yeah, that person. so they're all public domain books, largely from Project Gutenberg, but anybody can contribute by recording. You don't have to record a whole book, you can just record chapters that other people haven't done. And I listened to a few of them. Sometimes the voices are a bit bland and a bit monotonous.
Yeah, but it does the job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're clear recordings. So if you want to, if there's a book you've always wanted to read, but you just don't have the time, you can chuck it in your car stereo and listen to it over a week on your commute to work. So
that is brilliant.
That's quite cool.
Genuinely, in the past, actually, for somebody who can't see too well, I always meant to get around to doing this, something like this for them, you know, and then making something available for free if the source was there. And the fact that somebody's actually done it is brilliant.
There seems to be a lot of files on there, and they're all they're in MP3 and OGG format, and they're all hosted on archive.org because it doesn't seem a massively popular site, but there's a huge amount of potential bandwidth that could be ripped from there. So
that's really good.
Yeah, good luck to them. LibriVox, LibriVox.org. And my other discovery, the annoying one, is that Jimmy Wales, of the founder of Wikipedia, is one of the most annoying people on the planet. Purely from that relentless, non-stop advert on Wikipedia, his personal appeal. You've seen this, you know.
I've just blocked it out of my head, but yeah.
But I click the X to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And then, it just keeps coming back. And the worst thing is it's the last thing to load. So if you're on a fairly slow connection, you're reading a Wikipedia article about something and you're just getting into the text and then suddenly it all jumps down by 4 inches because this guy keeps appearing in my face all the time. And he's everywhere. You go to a different language Wikipedia. You go to the German language Wikipedia and he's there with a German message. It's the same for all sorts of languages. He's there in... as Esperanto, Vietnamese, Azerbaijani, even Latin. He's just there.
Did you see the Chrome extension that
Chrome extension that actually puts that personal appeal on every single website. But it's got to be backfiring. You know, the first time I saw it, I thought, I use Wikipedia a lot. Perhaps I should donate at some point. Now that, you know, after seeing it about 50 times and it really making my Wikipedia experience annoying, I don't hate him. I'm sure he's a great guy, but he's just become a really annoying figure in my head.
Also, those photos are pretty obnoxious. It's like he's got them perfectly. I mean, Wikipedia is a wonderful resource. I don't want to take anything away from it.
It's the best resource on the net for me.
Yeah, the fact that he's gone out and bought a suit, by the way. Yeah. Got a professional photographer standing by some, you know, nice piece of architecture and a personal plea from Jimmy Wales.
Yeah.
I'm pleasantly surprised that him and Julian Assange aren't the same person.
Who's to say they're not?
Unless he is in prison this morning.
So, yeah, Jimmy Wales, you know, just stop it, please.
Jimmy Wales is speaking at the Bristol Festival of Ideas in January.
Ah, so we can go in.
Yeah.
Actually, what we could do is every 5 minutes we can stand up and shout a personal appeal from Touch Radar.
A personal appeal from Andrew Gregory.
Yeah.
I'm a bit skint, Jimmy. Can you send us a tenner?
Are you going to get an interview with him?
I don't know. Do you think I should?
Yeah, I think you should.
There must be some sort of PR monkey to write to.
Try it.
Yeah.
Try it. That would be good.
Let's do that.
And then you can ask him.
For a tenner.
That's all this is about.
Finally.
Why?
Well, if it's a personal appeal, presumably if you click through, you can actually get personal contact with him. Otherwise, it'd be an appeal through my PR agency. So let's one of us click through and actually find out if he's got his email address there, and then you can get in touch directly.
Jimmy@wikipedia.org.
Yeah, and attach 20,000 pictures of yourself as well. Yeah. All right, and with such fun, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Next is You Dare Us, the results of our challenge. We've also got the hot seat where I'm the victim this episode, and our open ballot is to will 2011 be the year of Linux on the desktop?
Fantastic. So it's the You Dare Us section.
Right, and I was away for this.
You were away, and it was Paul's idea.
We can't be blamed.
As I remember it, it was... We need to try a different operating system and report back on our findings. Something he kind of implied that it shouldn't be Linux related.
There are other operating systems.
So I must admit, I didn't throw myself into this challenge, but through a course of my job, I do have to admit to using Macs quite frequently.
Well, we all do, don't we? Yeah. That's what the magazine's made.
That was going to be my contribution, that I used a Mac. So.
What else could I... What other operator...
Did you use Mac OS at all?
I didn't. Oh. Unfortunately, no, I didn't.
Swizz.
I installed a new OS on my netbook, but it's Linux.
What version of Linux?
It was Jolly Cloud 1.1.
That counts as new and different.
Yeah. Well, it's still Linux. I think the point was... Maybe to try and bring some ideas from a different desktop or a different environment and bring them into the Linux fold. Because there are certain things that OS X does brilliantly.
Well, the biggest thing that strikes me with OS X is that although it's a newbie-friendly operating system, it really does keep out of your face. There seems to be a growing trend in desktop Linux distributions to pop stuff up in your face all the time. In the default recent Ubuntu releases, you know, plug in a network cable, pop-up box that you can't even get rid of. It's just that black box that you try and hover the mouse over.
Yeah,
everything's making sounds and popping up messages. I don't need to know when I've plugged in my network cable. I've actually done that myself. You don't need to tell me. And there are all these little noises and pop-ups and distractions. And OS X doesn't have these. And OS X is pretty easy to use. So it's not like you need these things.
Yeah. Okay, so if we're going to choose OS X, should we all choose one thing from OS X that Linux should have, and then try and say one thing that OS X should have from Linux?
Well, can I say two things then? Because the lack of constant in-your-face pop-ups is one thing, and the package management system is a lot simpler on OS X. Self-contained folders with applications in, you can drag them to any folder and they'll work.
Yeah.
Whereas in Linux... you install a package and it explodes files all over different parts of your file system. It's a horrendous 1970s relic. It makes trying to find files and clear up packages really hard. OS X, I can put it wherever I want, in my dock, in my home folder, in applications. It's just a self-contained folder. That's simpler for users, simpler for administrators. Mm. That's the way it should be in 2010.
It does. It does work. In years gone by, it used to be a real pain that there was a resource and a data fork with Macs, but mostly that's been bypassed. I mean, when you're sharing files with people, I actually quite like the way that it's really a folder. And as soon as you open Bash on OS X, then you can actually just CD into those application folders and run the bin if you want to.
Yeah, it's just so self-contained. It's perfect.
We do need a package management solution. The thing
they don't have a package manager. That's the thing. You just have an app. If I want a program, I go to a website and get it. I don't need to go to a repository and explode stuff everywhere and deal with dependencies and stuff.
I think my thing. I don't know if this is going to be a flame fest, but it's the audio layer on OS X is just brilliantly implemented. Now the thing is, Pulse Audio has all the functionality. It has the same functionality. It can do the same thing. Specifically, it can plug and play, and you can route your audio from anywhere to anywhere. So Pulse Audio can do the same things, but the difference on OS X is that you don't see any of that complexity. In fact, most of the time all you see is that small icon at the top of the screen that's for controlling the volume. You can plug in new audio devices, you can unplug them while playing things back, you can quickly mute stuff, you know, it works across all the hardware, and it's super low latency, high performance, and there are native effects and instruments for it. And I think it's really one of its strongest cards, and you know, even works well on an iPhone and iPad, and they're the same. It's the same audio stack. All Pulse Audio needs to do is make itself look like that because it's got the functionality. That's the only thing I'd ask, really.
That's it. The technology is there.
The technology is there.
It seems so much of the case with Linux. The technology is there. There are great programmers and great hackers doing stuff, but it just needs to be organized and simplified.
Maybe they think that's the boring bit. Maybe they think the interesting bit, and you know, they're doing it, so I'm not going to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
But the interesting bit is adding all this cool functionality, getting it to work. Isn't this awesome? And then it's actually quite boring for someone else to come along and say, well, actually, we just want to hide all of this. You know, the power to have it is great, but also someone's got to come up with a script of what to happen when this does this. And well, that is the boring
bit. Yeah, and you've got to take away features from your own pet project, which is really, really difficult.
Yeah,
you know, you've worked hard on all these features, and then you've got to think, well, for the desktop, I perhaps should cut this out or hide this. And that's hard to do with your own baby, you know, to get rid of all the stuff that you want to announce to the world.
Yeah.
So what do you reckon, Andrew?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a Mac at home. I work on the one at work, and so I'm not allowed to install anything. So I've got no idea about the package management stuff because I have to phone up help desk and get someone's permission if I want to install Firefox or something like that.
Miles extension.
Yeah. So I don't know about that, but I do agree that the complexity being hidden is a very, very important part of Macs, because they're no cleverer really than Linux machines. It's the same sort of.
No, they're not. They're definitely not.
They both represent a big step up from Windows. It's just that one system sort of seems to shout about how clever it is, and then the other just is clever. And I'd like to take some of that onto Linux. The sort of technical understatedness, the way that you don't need to see scrolling pages of text when you install, the way that I think I like the way that everything looks the same on a Mac. But then the flip side of that is that it comes at the price of slowing developers down. I mean, if you've created a new cool feature like Compiz, you can get it into a distribution really, really quickly. Whereas if you had the sort of top-down control freak Apple way of doing things, then it would have to go through various design committees, and Jonathan Ive and Steve Jobs would have to sign it off, and then by the time you eventually got it a year later, it would be old,
and
everybody on Linux would have been playing with it for ages already.
A lot of Apple innovation actually comes from Linux, you know, and things like the pervasive searching, even the launch bar and spaces, all that really had its origin on the Linux desktop, and we don't make enough about that.
Beagle.
Yeah.
That was exactly. really cool.
And I suppose it's a bit frustrating that Apple shows us the way that it should be done. I mean, on OS X, yes, I use the Spotlight search to launch applications, and I'd love to be able to do the same thing. And you can do the same thing on Linux. It's just there isn't a standard way of doing it.
I think this shows really the fallacy of relying on the kernel contribution statistics to show who's doing the most work for Linux. If there's one organization that's trying to put all of Linux's cleverness together and put it under a nice glossy front end, it's Canonical. I mean, they seem like the ones most likely to harness Linux's clever good stuff and make it work as easily as Macs.
So, we ought to say something positive. I mean, is there anything that you take from Linux and drop it in OS X to make your working day better?
Well, the fact that when someone invents something, when someone creates a spinny cube,
cutting edge
stuff, it's there immediately.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait for someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is enough. I mean, fair enough, you know, you'll have to wait. Fair enough. It will be there eventually on a Mac or on another proprietary system, but then by the time that cool feature X is out, then you've already got cool feature Y and Z in Linux. If you want to play with the latest, coolest stuff, Linux is by far the place to be.
I think I miss the fact that the desktop isn't completely configurable, like KDE. You know, there's a lot, things like scripted backgrounds you cannot do. There isn't, in fact, on OS X, I know that there's a shareware solution. So you spend $25 and you get that. And I think you bump into that problem a lot with OS X. It just doesn't have the same open source-ness, despite the fact that so much of it is based on free software. And that's what I've always loved about Linux, and that's what I find missing whenever I move to a different operating system. The fact that people are willing to give everything away for free and spend effort getting it to work. And you can try all of this stuff without really going to any trouble, which doesn't happen on OS X. You know, you need to spend the money.
So, what are we going to do next podcast for you, Deros?
We were thinking of making the next podcast, which is going to be the last of the year, something of a retrospective. So that it always sounds like a cheat, but it's not, because we've covered an awful lot of ground in the 23 episodes.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to highlight some of the things that we thought were working and some of the things that weren't working and talk about what we'd like to do next year.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to look back over the news stories that we've covered. You know,
yeah,
all the things that have changed,
exactly, the highlights
the
of whatever's happened in free software. Yeah. So what we could do for each section, such as the Udera section, is talk about what we thought was our favourite Udera's, or the most, you know, well, I'm not going to talk about it, but the games, they were great.
Yeah, the ones we worked hardest on, definitely.
Mine was awesome.
Yeah.
So
soon to be released.
Maybe we
vaporware.
Should just do that.
Yeah, that'll do. That'll be a nice change.
Okay, cool. Okay, so it's now time for In the Hot Seat, which, as our listeners may remember, I made such a disaster of last episode, you wouldn't have liked it.
Oh dear, never mind.
Fortunately, common sense has returned, and it's Mike's turn.
I'm back. I am the victim.
An arbitrary decision. And, you know, I've brought in some, I've tied a small synthesizer to the Wheel of Misfortune.
Really?
So that, yeah, when it goes past the rod that we use to choose which category it's going to be, what the subject's going to be, it actually makes a sound.
Okay.
So
I'm a bit scared.
That's the highlight, but we've got the same array of topics on there that we just kind of make up before we come into this room.
Mm.
Grub is still there. Magia, we can take that off. That was what I did.
My gear.
Yeah, which I spent 5 seconds talking about.
Cool. So.
So let's see how it goes.
Let's give this wheel a spin.
Good luck, Mike.
Thanks. Whoa! No, not Grub, please.
Gimp?
It's version numbers.
Version numbers? Who put that on there?
Oh, I don't know. So what have I got? 1 minute? I've got to talk non-stop for 1 minute about version numbers. Is that correct? Have you got a timer ready there? I'm take a huge deep breath because I'm going to talk with one breath.
Okay. Go.
Wow, version numbers. Version numbers in the free software world are sometimes used very well and carefully, and sometimes they seem to make no sense whatsoever. I mean, the window maker, window manager, which I have used on and off for years now, probably almost a decade now, it's been on 0.92 for probably about 5 years, and why don't they just call it 1.0? It's stable, it's full of features, because 1.0 does make all the difference. When I was releasing early versions of macOS, like in 0.4x and 0.5x on SourceForge, I would also also make note of this on Fresh Meat, and some people would download it a few, but as soon as I called it 1.0, the downloads quadrupled or quintupled because people saw it as a finished project. And some people give their projects ridiculously long numbers, like 3.2.1.4.7. It doesn't look cool. You know, there's nothing great about that. Just stick to a decent system. 4.1 becomes 4.2 when you add new features or a new API. If you add a bug fix or a security fix, simply call it 4.1.1 and 4.1.2 and so forth, and everything will be happy in the world.
Just beginning there, Mike.
Yes. Well, after maybe next season, we'll extend it to 5 minutes.
Oh, no.
Well done. That was good.
Great. So,
lots of valid points.
Valid points.
Lovely valid points.
What's happened to the wheel?
Oh, no.
The wheel's broken.
Oh. I love that wheel. Ow. What have you done to it?
It's time for the open ballot.
Hooray!
The last open... Is it the last open ballot of the year?
Probably will be now, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Why don't we have an open ballot next time? Like, what was your most awesome thing of...
Great idea.
Yeah.
Cool. Idea. Okay.
Right. That was simple.
That's time for the end of the show. No, not really. Open ballots in which we asked you, yes, you, is 2011 going to be the year of Linux on the desktop?
Yes or no?
Yes or no? Overwhelmingly, the responses have tended in one direction.
Yes. We're here. Welcome to the sunny uplands of success.
Sadly, no. Although one wag reckons that next year is going to be the year of Herd on the desktop.
Get in.
Who's that man?
Well, if I use it, then that's double the number of users, so...
Nye, not verified, says 2020 will be the year of Herd on the desktop. So
it's quite optimistic.
There we go. Maybe Linus Torvalds should offer large amounts of money to Sepp Blatter so that Linux can be the official FIFA desktop.
A personal appeal from Linus Torvalds.
Yeah.
He should have that when the kernel boots.
Will that be enough?
Anyway, Mike, what do you think?
I see Linux as moving more and more into the mobile space, and I see computing moving more and more towards mobile anyway. Now, tablets are going to be huge, absolutely huge, and smartphones, everybody's getting smartphones, and this is somewhere where Linux can do really well, you know, where a lot of the old technology has been jettisoned in favour of new ideas designed from the ground up for usable touch computing, mobile computing. So, I think it will continue to make progress on the desktop. It's always getting better bit by bit. I don't think it'll make any magical breakthrough in 2011. It will just get better, easier all the time. But I think, you know, by the end of next year, we could see a lot of Android tablets out there. So Linux could be, you know, selling many, many millions.
That's what Johnville says. If trends carry on as is, the home desktop and laptop will become just another niche market. Most people are already pulled into some kind of mobile device. And AJ, not verified, says it will be the year of the Android.
Well, yeah, I have to completely agree. I think it's a question that goes back from a time when desktop seemed so important to us because we spent so much time in front of it. But now I don't spend quite so much time in front of a desktop and they're not that important. You know, I think we've said this before, but I do think Linux has succeeded in ways that were unimaginable when Linus started it. The Android is incredibly successful, and it's still very, very successful in the server space and for running websites and in all kinds of ways that just aren't the desktop. If you replace desktop for, is this the year of Linux? And I would say yes. But in terms of the desktop, you know, I think we dropped the ball when Vista flopped and Apple moved to OS X. I think we could be doing so much more to, I think our children should be using Linux desktops because it's an open platform and they're open standards. I think education, government, those kind of places should be using Linux more than they are. And that's where I'd like to see it. I don't really want to see any more Linux be more popular on the desktop than Windows or OS X because I don't think we can do it.
Well, Toby says, no, I'm quite pessimistic on that question. I think Vista gave us the biggest opportunity, echoing what you just said, and we completely failed to bring desktop Linux to the mass market.
Oh dear, that's quite grim. But three people have commented with ifs and buts, conditional statements. Not yes nor no. But Kiwi says, when a law is passed that PC retailers must offer two prices, one with Windows and one without, then we will have a year of Linux on the desktop.
Well, the law, the government and law can't start telling shops what to do.
Well, there was that EU competition thing about bundling Windows with Internet Explorer, wasn't there?
That's fair enough.
So it's not inconceivable.
No, but that's them forcing people to use a certain piece of software. You can't start telling shops what to do and which products to sell and not, otherwise...
Well, you can tell them not to sell drugs.
Well, yeah, all right then, but you really start messing around with the shop's ability to just sell computers if you pass laws.
Well, that's that. We also have another could-be here from Kip, or Sip, who says, it could be if one or more important hardware providers choose as distribution... Hang on. Let me just rearrange this into English. Kip, or Sif, says, it could be if one or more of the important hardware providers chooses Linux as its default OS on an iPad killer or on a Walmart Best Buy. That's, going back to Android and the mobile space again. And don't forget that the administrations and schools are playing on other rules. God knows what that means. Slightly ominously, Anonymous Penguin says,
oh.
It all comes down to whether KDE4 sets the tone or not.
Wow, yes, I can't wait it is. For KDE4.
If KDE gets it right, the world will be good.
Yep. Because GNOME is, well, let's face it, Windows XP's ugly cousin.
Wow.
GNOME is many things, but comparing it to XP is something I've never been able to do.
Does it come with Minesweeper?
It used to, didn't it?
I think so. It used to come with GNOME Mines or something.
Yeah.
Any more words of wisdom from our...
Well, quite a few people seem to not care.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Not because of apathy, but because they've got Linux running on their desktop and they're quite happy with it, so we're hey. Mika says, for those of us lucky enough to have already made the switch to Linux... And for the relatively few of us who will make the switch in 2011, it doesn't much matter. Our computing will be productive, enjoyable, and ever-improving, even if 98 or 95% of the public can't say the same. Toey!
Yay! Mr. Bain.
Says, I really hope so. My two neighbours are more than happy with their Ubuntu installations. My neighbours are more than happy with their Ubuntu installations and seldom ask about viruses and such now. Smiley face.
Wow. Isn't this all slightly academic, though, because the world's going to end in 2012?
Who says that?
Oh, I don't know. Some people on the internet.
North Koreans.
Is it going to end before or after the European Cup in Poland and Ukraine?
Oh, I don't know when that is.
Because that could save me a lot of money, potentially.
You'll need the money.
You never know. You might take it into a next life.
So. That's true. They might be right. Yeah. All of those things the Egyptian kings had in their tomb are there with them now.
Yeah.
Øystein Stadskliev, Norway.
Is that his name or where he comes from?
Or perhaps Øystein Stadskliev in Norway comes back with the laconic, does it matter?
Wow.
It doesn't matter, no. None of this matters. In the end, we're all dust.
If somebody installs a distro in a forest and nobody was there to complain it didn't have GNU in front of it.
Well, there we go. Bill Stone says that Vista 7 is the last gasp of air for MS, and that's S with the dollar sign.
Last gasp of air? Haven't they made record profits or something recently?
A lot of people I know are unhappy with Vista 7, but don't want to switch because they already have something that works well enough. When it's time to move on from Vista 7, Linux will be king on desktops. Also, I pray viruses will kill Windows off before long. We must be close. I can smell the burning silicon dioxide coming from Redmond. Outdated question.
That's probably the most disturbed thing I've ever heard. It's the most, loaded with zealotry and completely divorced from reality comment that's probably ever been posted.
Well, yeah. It's a
contentious question, isn't it? It's a good question for debate, and it's a good question to see where we're all at. You know, what does everyone think about Linux this year? Pretty good, I think.
Oh, excuse me, sorry.
That's all right. We forgive you, Andrew. See, everybody's been a bit ill at the moment, so we're working especially hard to bring you this podcast, listeners.
What sort of operating systems do we think WikiLeaks uses?
It must be OpenBSD on a VAX.
This is probably, yeah, a totally cloud operating system, different bits in different parts of the world.
I wonder if Julian Assange has an iPad.
No.
I think...
He doesn't have a credit card, does he? He just has cash.
And a Swiss bank account.
This whole WikiLeaks thing really shows... I mean, sorry to put a downer on this Linux-y, computer-based podcast. But it really shows the limitations of computers and electronic communications. I mean, how many cables were stolen?
250,000 or something.
Released into the wild. 250,000. Imagine stealing 250,000 sheets of A4 paper. It just, you'd need a big van and several blokes drinking like loads of cups of tea with sugar in.
I guess it depends how you do it. I've probably stolen that many pieces of paper from this company over the 5 years I've been here. But
over 5 years? Someone would notice. Someone would have noticed. So there. Go back to using carrier pigeons, people.
Yeah, and try and capture 250,000 of them and keep them in your loft.
Yeah, Graham Greene couldn't really write about it today, could he? They tapped into the email address. They tapped into Cameron's Hotmail account. saved it to his USB stick and ran away.
And with such wonderful merriment, we come to the end of this episode's podcast. Join us in a couple of weeks.
Right. What? I actually have one more thing.
What, you've taken over the one more thing now?
And no, not permanently. This is because I have one more thing to say. Quite an important thing.
Please go ahead.
Because, as people might be aware, there's been a lot of change at Linux Format Magazine.
Change we can believe in.
Tux Radar podcast. And we're in the fortunate position that we can employ a new member on the team. Mm-hmm. Someone to join Mike, Andrew, and I, hopefully here in the podcast, and definitely down in the office where we type our words and make the wonderful Linux format. So we've got a staff writer position. I'll put the link to the job description in the podcast notes. And if you're at all interested in working with Linux, writing about Linux, working with us, doing all the things that we do, and enjoying having a great time, I think, mostly, drop us a line.
And fetching us coffee as well, which is important.
Must be knowledgeable and able to speak good English.
Yeah.
Like me, blah.
About
Linux and be able to write English. Those are really the two pillars on which everything else must stand.
Yeah,
be pretty awesome as well.
Be pretty awesome.
Yeah,
we'll take a look at everybody's application and pick the most awesome person for the job.
Wow, that's going to be cool. So, yeah, clicky the linky if you're interested in it.
That's the best thing.
You're going to put it up, aren't you, Graham?
I'll put the link in. The job's already up there on various job sites and on Future Zone job site, but I'll put the link.
Oh, brilliant!
In the podcast notes.
Cool. Do we know how long it will be up for?
No, there is no closing date. So what we'll probably do is leave it up there till the new year sometime.
Excellent.
And see how it goes from there.
So there we go. You've got plenty of time to put in your perfectly crafted application to say why you're awesome and want to be with us in the magical Linux Format offices. Great. So we'll be back in probably around 2 weeks or so, just before Christmas.
Yeah, for our last one.
Yeah, for a look back on the year and... Yep, and then that will be it. That will be the end of season two. So
who'd have thought it?
Who'd have thunk it, eh? Wow. Okay, see you soon, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.